Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
We talked to the writer Kevin Fedarko a few weeks ago about his 750-mile expedition walking from one end of the Grand Canyon to the other, an experience he described with words like misery and defeat and shame, but also euphoria. Betsy Burton loved Fedarko's book. It's called A Walk in the Park.
Well, this trek is no walk in the park. And these two unprepared people, ill-equipped, not in shape, ill-informed, join a group of very experienced trekkers and can't keep up and have too much weight on their backs to be able to get along and have to go back finally. But they regroup and they start again. And as they go, honestly, this is the highest adventure. And as they look down 1,000-foot cliffs and down into slot canyons, drop down, your heart's in your throat. But on top of all of that, there is history. There is prehistory, the prehistory of the 11 tribes that originally inhabited this land, the history of the explorers and of the land itself, and the history of the formation of the park. And as they near the end of this amazing journey, they make a discovery. And I thought that the discovery they made in this time of turbulation in which we live was really important.
What I would later call even more vividly than the visual splendor of the canyon's final flaring was the one-act drama that opened each evening as night fell across the Sanup, when a wave of absolute silence once again washed over the land. A silence so pure and clean, flecked with starlight and chilled by the currents of cold autumn air, that it seemed to form its own river, spilling down the faces of the cliffs, flooding the pockets of shallow ground, pooling and deepening until the entire plateau was bathed in a hush that seemed to charge the senses, quicken the conscience, and settle the mind all at once. As usual, it was Pete who noticed it well before I did.
You know, we're all just so fraught right now. We're separated into tribes and the world is in chaos. And what they came to at the end of this very chaotic journey, I felt to be so important. I think it's the best book of the year. I just adore it.
This is the time of day when, if you really listen, you don't hear anything at all. It's the silence. That's the most important thing.
That's Kevin Fedarko reading from his book, A Walk in the Park. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, it's our annual summer book show, where we offer reading ideas for the vacation summer season. Now, we're going to move fast here, so maybe grab something to write with, because we have with us for the hour our usual suspects, along with Betsy Burton, co-founder of the King's English Bookshop. We have Catherine Weller of Weller Bookworks and Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books. Okay, here we go. A couple of quick questions I want to ask at the top. First, this. What do you like to read on vacation? Because I'm trying to get a sense of how that might be, and we'll talk about this, maybe a little different from the everyday stuff. So what do you like to read on vacation? Mm-hmm. Betsy, what do you start?
At the beginning of a vacation, I like something that's pure escape. I like maybe a thriller. And then when my mind gets rested and I get a little restless, I want a really good book to read. And when it comes to that, I'm okay with a novel or nonfiction, just as long as it's really good. And then at night when I'm trying to sleep, I've taken to reading audio. I mean, not reading, but listening to. And I just want to say that I've discovered a collection by Josephine Tay that I can listen to over and over and over again at night and always go to sleep, but I know what's going to happen.
Catherine, what about you?
Well, I have to admit, this question's given me pause.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. And
wait, why?
because I've never thought about my reading thus. But of course, when I'm going on vacation, I'm packing books.
Yeah.
And I realized what I'm reading on vacation is not nearly so well thought out as Betsy. It is what I wanted to read during the season that I couldn't get to. As booksellers, we're always reading ahead. There are the books we can't get to that we know we would have loved, or the additional book I couldn't ever read. You know, I read a book that may have given me some London history, and so I wanted to circle back and maybe read some Pepys or something. Johnson, that's when I can do that.
Yeah, that's great.
Doug, what this concept, vacation? What is that?
Doesn't go with bookseller, does it?
Not really. I mean, if I'm flying somewhere, I will, as I think Kat alluded to, I'm going to pick a book that there's no way in heck I'm going to otherwise read. And it doesn't matter how big it is, and I'll read it on the plane.
Yeah.
Because a captive audience of one. Every year for 7 years or so now, my friend, the musician Kate McLeod, and I do these Whitewater River trips through a company called Crate. It's not really conducive to do reading on rafts rowing through rapids, but we, you know, she does musical entertainment. She writes songs and performs them that very night, songs she writes in the river. And I tell stories and lies. And I take a whole ammo can full of books that I've, you know, tried and true that I read from. And so they're old friends by now. We even have videotape of me reading Gertrude Stein in the Grand Canyon.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. But I guess the question is it different, your reading, from the day-to-day reading?
Yes.
Okay.
Absolutely
because
different.
You have to read. You know, we have a litany of things that we have to read every season, and we're always running behind. We don't have free time to read.
Yeah, it's the leisure moment for us, the recreational reading. I mean, reading is a pleasure. Otherwise, I don't think the three of us would be doing this job. But being able to choose and have it just be purely recreational, that's pretty golden.
So not all of you are reading for escape. You'll still read the thick, deep stuff even on a beach.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay. How do you read on vacation? And that may be different. That's the question, too. In other words, I'll read a little bit from this one, and I'll go to this one, and do you read differently?
I always read from cover to cover. Okay. I hate to skip. And the older I get, the truer that is, because I can't remember long enough to go back and forth.
Yeah.
Same. You know, I know people who read 3 and 4 books at a time, and they say they say it helps them focus and they can somehow keep those narrative threads apart. Mm-hmm. Not me. I'm cover to cover, one book.
Yep.
I'm a one book man as well. It's hard enough just with one. And the days of being able to read, you know, a book or more a day,
forget it.
They're gone now. Yeah. That's never going to happen again. I think the most I ever read was 5 books in one day. I happened to be sick and home that day.
Mm. Yeah, right.
That helps.
All right. Well, let's jump in. This is adult fiction. Betsy, you start.
Well, I'm going to start with Colm Tobin's Long Island. For those of you readers out there who've read Brooklyn or seen the movie, which is very good indeed, this picks up the story of Eilis. And she has been in Long Island for a long time with a man she married who is Italian, American-Italian, big, close family, pretty happy, 2 teenage kids, knock, knock on the door, and the man's there when she opens the door who says, "Your husband impregnated my wife, and the baby's not going to be at our house. I'm bringing him to your front step." And her world tilts. Mm. She goes in, she says to herself, "No, I'm not doing this. This isn't what I'm going to do." And of course, the Italian-American family wants the baby, and you can just imagine she goes to Ireland. So it's kind of the reverse, or the same in a way, of Brooklyn, but this is a very different Eilis. She is a woman in full possession of herself. She knows who she is. She goes to Ireland, surprised by her mother's distance, meets the man that she almost left her husband for. So it's the same kind of situation, but totally different because she's so different. It's a fascinating novel, and I loved it. Long Island by Colm Tobin.
Yes.
And then, next, another Irish novel, Soldier Sailor by Claire Kilroy. Now, this is interesting to me because the book opens and the narrator has her arms around someone you think must be her lover. She's looking with such love and adoration, but it's an infant. Mm-hmm. And this book is about a first-time mother. It's about what it's like to have an infant. And, you know, it's the mix of love and despair, fatigue, half insanity that happens, especially with your first, because you didn't expect this. Mm-hmm. And it's so completely crazy-making. And she takes this. The husband goes to work, stays later and later, goes earlier and early. She's lost in this space with this infant and nearly goes mad. And then when the baby is a toddler, the boy, she goes crazy in a different way because she feels like she's like padlocked to the swing set. She can never look away. It's all so hard. And for me, at least, it was this hard. I had colicky babies. And I've been in denial my whole life about that truth. And when I read this, it was a total illumination. I said, oh, my God, that is what it was like. Not all of it, but that was what it was like. It's a brilliantly written book and Irish, well-reviewed in Ireland, and I loved it. Soldier Sailor, Claire Kilroy. Another book that I really liked, Howard Norman has been shortlisted for all kinds of prizes. And he's got a new book called Come to the Window that I almost put in the mystery section, but it really is both. It's set in around World War I. Spanish flu is there. He's a crime reporter. A woman has killed her husband on her wedding night. It isn't the whodunit. We know that. But why did she do that on her wedding night? That's part of it. But he is married to a woman who's a doctor who's treating people back from the war, treating victims of Spanish flu. You'd think, oh, how dark, how hopeless. This couple, they love each other. They're kind of funny together. They speak, you know, deeply about things. So there's this kind of balance in this book that's just lovely. It's called Come to the Window, and it's by Howard Norman. And just very quickly, I wanted to mention the fourth one, Welcome to Glorious Tuga by Francesca Seagull. A great read about a young woman who's very kind of interior. She's studying veterinary medicine, but not because she wants to be a vet, only because she's a scientist. She writes a grant, goes to an island called Tuga, and where there are these golden tortoises who are a threatened species, and where she thinks her father, who her mother has never talked to her about, might be. So it's just this glorious, interesting read, great characters, couple of love interests, just a true pleasure to take on your vacation.
Yep. All right, Kat.
Miranda July. She is a filmmaker. She is a performance artist of kinds. She is an artist and she is a writer. Her latest book, All Fours, one could think is autofiction, and maybe it is, maybe it isn't. I ask people to not speculate. She hasn't said it is. But it is about a, quote, semi-famous artist, unquote.
Ooh, intriguing.
Who, yeah, is much like July herself. Quirky, intelligent, obsessive, a journeying kind of woman, as she refers to herself later in the book, who takes money that she got from a company to use for a jingle. She's going to go on a cross-country trip to New York, and she gets 30 miles away from her home, stops in Monrovia, California, checks into a hotel room, and begins this really bent, obsessive quest to integrate herself into a romantic relationship with the guy at the Hertz counter. She remodels the hotel room into this work of beauty and art, a thing of rarity. And she explores midlife and the second part of life and what that means for a woman today. It is just incandescent with rage and desperation and fury and sex. So much sex. Here's a warning. If it's not explicit sex, but it is there, and there are things and words that might make people uncomfortable. But what she's doing is creating a room of her own, very literally and very figuratively,
wow,
for the next part of her life. It's stunning. It's called All Fours by Miranda July. This next book, Martyr, by Kaveh Akbar, Betsy and I were just waxing eloquently about this book. The character, Cyrus Shams, he's a lot of things. He is an Iranian-born U.S. citizen. He's an addict who is in recovery sometimes. He's a queer who passes as straight. He's a poet who, as he writes, drinks about writing, not writes about drinking. He's a medical actor, and he's deeply and profoundly sad. His mother was killed on a flight from Iran to Dubai, and for his whole life he's been suicidal and looking for meaning and how to have a meaningful death and what that is, and he decides he needs to be a martyr. He interacts with a performance artist, worlds open, worlds closed. It is lovely and sad and comic at the same time. He is a poet, and you can see it in his writing. It's beautiful. Lastly, Callie Ann Bradley wrote this novel, Ministry of Time. It's her first novel, and it started as a bunch of fan fiction. She was writing about an Arctic explorer who died in the Arctic that she found, and she turned it into a novel, a time travel novel, in fact, in which England discovers time travel and begins bringing people back from history. They don't want to go forward because that'll screw stuff up. You go backwards, and they're bringing all these people back from history. The protagonist is what's called a bridge, a person who helps the people they've brought back from history accommodate their lives and adjust to modern day London. So what's great about this novel is that's the only mention of time travel. No mechanics, no science fiction. It is character driven and it's picaresque. The middle is just so lovely with these adventures the bridge takes her Arctic explorer on. It's enjoyable. It's adventurous. This is a good summer read.
Say the Minister of Time.
Yes. Ministry of Time.
Ministry of Time.
By Callie Ann Bradley.
All right, Kat, thanks a lot. Ken Sanders.
Doug. James Percival Everett, a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize. This is a retelling, if you will, of Huckleberry Finn. But this time it's from Jim or James's point of view. Yeah. And let's just say Jim or James has decidedly different point of view of the entire voyage account and aftermath than, say, Huck did. Really brilliant. Fine novel. I like it. Our old friend, James by Percival Everett.
Great.
Our old friend Rick Bass has got a new collection of short stories and essays out called With Every Great Breath. Mm. It's kind of after 30 books or so, Rick's kind of burnt out on trying to save the endangered yak and, you know, all these pieces of land and critters that live in it, and it's exhausting work. So you kind of got to take a break once in a while and get back to your roots and write about things that are a little more uplifting and positive. And I think that our friend Rick Bass has done that.
We talked to him about that book. He's still worried about bears, of course.
Oh, of course. He's never going to give up bears.
Right.
Leaf Anger. Peace Like a River is probably the most famous book. Yeah. I Cheerfully Refuse. Mm. This is a novel about a morose musician who's lost his wife and goes out on this lake searching for her. His wife is a bookseller.
Uh-oh.
Find out how that ends up.
Look how succinct Ken is being, everybody. He is speeding through this segment.
Well, that's because I want to spend time with Joan Baez.
All right.
She has her first book of poetry out. Come on. You got every word out of her mouth has been poetry for more than 50 years, right? How can this be the first time she ever, not put it on ink, but apparently published her own poetry? For a really good roundup of those days of Woody Guthrie and the Weavers and, you know, Odetta and before the coming of Bob Dylan, who Joan Baez had a lot to do with that. If you want to read about that wonderful when folk ruled before the rock and roll took over in the late 50s, early 60s, read a wonderful old book called Positively Fourth Street. It's really illuminating. But this new book of Joan Baez, When You See My Mother, Ask Her to Dance. Is Joan Baez a great poet as a songwriter? You know, they're not the same thing, although they're really, really interrelated, interconnected. Hmm. So I want to let Joan talk here, not me. Two short poems. Judy, backstage, we embraced. I buried my face in my hands, and the conversation we never had tumbled out. It was a long road, you said. Forgive me for never being there, I said. I buried my face in my hands. You buried your son in the ground. Obviously talking about Judy Collins there. Yeah. Portrait. I really love this one, Doug. After E.E. Cummings, Robert Zimmerman, blue-eyed son from Duluth, used to scribble thought dreams, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 songs, just like that. Brilliant stuff. He was a brilliant kid. And what I want to know is, who's writing that kind of stuff today, Mr. Creator?
It's a reference to Bob, I guess.
Bobby Zimmerman.
Ken Sanders. Ken Sanders' Rare Books. We also have with us Catherine Weller of Weller Bookworks and Betsy Burton. She's the co-founder of the King's English Bookshop. We have a list of all of these titles and, of course, the ones we won't get to. Put it on our website at RadioWest.org. Take a break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Support for the Radio West podcast comes from Harmon's Grocery, committed to excellent service and friendly smiles. Your food is our passion.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, it's our annual summer book show. We have with us our group of book experts to offer ideas for your summer season, books for the beach or the cabin or wherever it is you're headed. We have with us Betsy Burton, co-founder of the King's English Bookshop, Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Rare Books, and Catherine Weller of Weller Bookworks. In her stack of books, Catherine had one for the memoir-reading punk rock crowd. It's called Rebel Girl, My Life as a Feminist Punk, by Kathleen Hanna. Hanna is the frontwoman of the band Bikini Kill.
They brought the feminism to punk. Their chant was girls to the front to try to get women up to the front of the stage to be able to see the shows. And there is a song that still to this day young women use as the anthem in their heads. It's called Rebel Girl. Because she came up, Kathleen, in this time period, she really has seen a lot in some very formative times within punk rock. And what she describes in this book is very journalistic. It's very episodic. It's almost like from her journals themselves. And so it's a very immediate feeling. I love this sense of you're there in the moment sometimes that we can hear with discussions about hanging out at Kurt Cobain's house one day and kind of going off the rails.
And then I saw Kurt climbing through my window. He was holding yellow daffodils that I recognized instantly. I picked them for you, he said. Like I was Darla in The Little Rascals and he was Alfalfa.
This is a different version of punk than we've seen a lot of punk histories about. Kathleen doesn't shy away from the sexism she faced all the way through.
Oh, sh**. Those are Darren's, I said. He's been trying to grow them for months. Oh, sh**. You got those from his window box. Sh**. Kurt dropped them, roots and all, onto the floor. I explained loudly not to worry. Darren is this guy who decided to take care of me, I said. He makes me dinner all the time. He's my caretaker, basically. I was a young feminist, and I was trying to sound cool, trying to fit into the tough girl persona I assumed Kurt and Dave had of me.
And yet, the incredible empowerment that girls and women and punks in general felt in that period of the late 80s and 90s, as we are looking at how young people are so angry today, and rightfully so, looking back at that anger that is kind of unresolved from that time period is a way to see where we've come from, look at this world afresh, but also enjoy the vibrancy of a really intelligent woman who tells it like it is from the trenches.
Really, Darren was one of my closest friends, my confidant and my lifeline. But I went on to describe him as if he was some loser I was just using. I wanted to give them what I thought they wanted. And I also wanted to make Kurt feel okay about rooting up the three flowers Darren had worked months to produce.
Kathleen Hanna, reading from her book, Rebel Girl, My Life as a Feminist Punk. Okay, back to our group of book experts. Here's Catherine again.
I'm going to start with a book that is heartbreaking, as her books often are. Alexandra Fuller is a lovely writer who blew onto the scene many, many years ago with Don't Let Go to the Dogs Tonight, about her childhood in Zimbabwe with her next level parents, just over the top. She's immigrated to America and she's had a rocky life. She's a journeying kind of woman who lives life very deeply and fully. And when her son, Fee, was 21 years old, he died suddenly in his sleep one night, apropos of nothing. Had a bit of some seizures here and there, but nothing that would lead one to believe she'd wake up and find her son dead. This book is about the healing journey that she took to come to grips with the death of a child, which is one of those things that is just unimaginable. For anybody who's a parent, it's the kind of thing that just punches you in the gut. It rips your heart out just thinking about it. She ends up staying in a sheep wagon for a while up in the mountains. She's at a Greek sanctuary in New Mexico. She meditates. She takes all of these journeys to try to find a way to peace and acceptance. And it is an honest and beautiful book about, yeah, one of those most painful things we can imagine. It's so hard and so beautiful and worth reading.
So
it's called Fee by Alexandra Fuller, and Fee is spelled F-I, just to trip you up there.
Yeah.
Trippy, completely different, is by Ernesto Londoño, who is a New York Times correspondent and a man who is deep in PTSD, suicidal ideation and depression, found himself taking a trip to go on an ayahuasca journey with great cynicism. First ayahuasca experience, he's like, yeah, whatever. Second one, he's even more skeptical. The third one just blew his mind and began his healing journey. He approaches the new psychedelic medicinal realm with a certain amount of skepticism. He walked in with it. He doesn't drop that skepticism. He stays true to journalism throughout and admits there are problems. There are problematic people. There are problematic circumstances. There are problems. But he also explores the promise in the use of things like ayahuasca, MDMA, psilocybin, all of those things. And he weaves this in with his own recovery from PTSD and his suicidal ideation. It's called Trippy by Ernesto Londoño. Finally, I came to this book late, and it's really something. It's called Slavery in Zion. She calls it a documentary and genealogical history of Black lives and Black servitude in Utah Territory. There are a lot of family stories about the people, the Black people who came with the founding families. And the standard line is, oh, they were free. They came here of their own accord. She goes about proving how that cannot possibly be the case. There was a legal process that is well documented for freeing people. None of those people were that. So the first part is recognizing these people and then delving into their biographies, the little that we have on enslaved people, because we don't have a lot of biography on enslaved people. But this is an important book for Utah history. It's called Slavery in Zion by Amy Tanner Theriot. Really quickly, graphic novel. It's a biography, Tessa Hull's Feeding Ghosts, about her trip through her family's stories that start with a grandmother who escaped communist China and was in with Chiang Kai-shek, rolling on over into Taiwan with her mom and then into America and deep, deep into intergenerational trauma. Feeding Ghosts by Tessa Hulse.
Great. Yeah, thank you. Ken Sanders, over to you.
I'd like to start off with a new book called The Arch's Reader, Doug. It's edited by Jeffrey Nichols at Westminster and published by the University of Utah Press. It's an anthology in a series of national park readers. It took some 5 or 6 years to get this thing going. I really, really like it because he includes a lot of academic historians, shall we say, but he also includes the likes of people like me. So it's many faceted. Jim's the late curmudgeon Arches Park Ranger for decades and publisher of the Canyon Country, Jim Stiles. Yep. He's got several posthumous pieces in here. Bates Wilson, there's lots of the father of Canyonlands, and his son's, it's actually an oral interview, one of the best pieces in the book. What I like about what Jeff has done is the diversity of viewpoints, all about talking about the same place that we all know and dearly love. Mm-hmm. I was just there with my children and grandchildren a few days ago. Got to take my kids to see both Canyonlands and Arches National Park for their first times. Marvelous experience, marvelous book, and thanks to Jeff Nichols for doing it. It's called The Arches Readers by Jeffrey Nichols.
Great.
Next up is Benjamin E. Park, An American Zion. This is a new history of Mormonism, but it's old. It goes way back. He claims to have 20 years of access to documents that some of our great historians, from Dale Morgan to Will Bagley to Rick Turley and contemporaries, didn't. Well, Turley would always, as church historian, he would always have access to them. But most outsider, sorry, I had to catch myself. Most outsider historians wouldn't have access to what's locked up in those vaults. But it's a new era, and he really takes a look at it from a new perspective, and he goes way back to pre-Mormonism right up to contemporary Mormonism, and I think it's a really good, solid contribution, and I think that it isn't a book about is Mormonism real or not. It's a book trying to tell its history so you can make up your own minds, and I think it's a much-needed book. Lastly, I have three books that kind of are about the same thing. What we're experiencing in contemporary America that seemingly is killing us and poisoning us as a society, as a people, and why people on the left and the right are saying, you know, this country is all messed up. It's wrong. We got to fix it. We got to stop it. And it just, everybody is saying the same thing, even though we mean something completely different by it. So the three books are This System is Killing Us, by Xander Dunlap, Land Grabbing, the Green Economy, and Ecological Effect. The Hammer, Power, Inequality, and the Struggle for the Soul of Labor, by Hamilton Nolan. Making It in America, by Rachel Slade. The Almost Impossible Quest to Manufacture in the USA, and How It Got That Way. They seem diverse, but I think they're all about the same bloody thing.
Betsy Burton.
Well, I'm going to start with Sex and the Planet, What Opt-in Reproduction Could Do for the Globe, by Margaret Pabst Batten. Now, Margaret Pabst Batten, Peggy, to most of us who know her, is a professor of philosophy at the university. She's a brilliant woman. She's known throughout the world for her expertise in philosophy. And one of her most favorite things to do is to do thought experiments. And the thought experiment simply presupposes something to be true and says, if this is so, then what will happen? And her thought experiment in this book is, if contraception were totally effective, if it were long-term, if it were easy to obtain and distribute, and if it was very inexpensive, what would happen to abortion? Well, this is a book full of figures and charts and all of this stuff, but her obvious conclusion is there would be no need for abortion unless for a medical reason. It's a fascinating book, and I think everybody should read it. It's Sex and the Planet, What Opt-in Reproduction Could Do for the Globe, by Margaret Pabst Batten. My next book is in a very different order. It's not new. It was given to me by a fellow bookseller, Sally Larkin, who said that she thought I needed it. It's The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating by Elizabeth Tova Bailey. And this is a book about a woman who was struck down by a really terrible virus, which completely debilitated her. But what happens is this book, she had lived on a farm. She was a brilliant writer, lots of friends, very active. This struck her down. She ends up in a facility with a caregiver with four white walls and a window, and somebody gives her a little pot of wild violets and a snail. And the first night, she notices that the papers on her bedside table have a square hole in them. The second night, there are more. And the third night, she thinks she hears chewing. And that's what she is hearing. So this is a book about her observation of the snail, this person who's totally isolated and as close to despair as you can get, who finds a purpose, not an obsession, a quiet purpose. And this book, it does examine the snail in great detail. They're incredible creatures, actually. And there are descriptions from everybody to E.O. Wilson to backyard naturalists. It's just a lovely, lovely book and a very profound one. The Sound of a Wild Snail Eating by Elizabeth Tova Bailey.
Betsy Burton co-founded the King's English Bookshop in Salt Lake City. She's here with Catherine Weller of Weller Bookworks at Trolley Square, Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders Ware Books, just off 2nd South and 2nd East in Salt Lake. If you didn't get a chance to write down a title, not to worry. We have all of the books, even the ones we didn't have time for, on our website at radiowest.org. We'll take another break and come back in a moment. This is Radio West.
Support for Radio West comes from listeners like you. Become a member at KUER.org.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. And it's our annual summer book show with our usual group of book experts talking about books you could take with you on vacation. Catherine Weller is with us, along with Betsy Burton and Ken Sanders. One of Ken's books is the story of Heidi Red. She's a rancher who runs cattle on the Colorado Plateau. She sold her dugout ranch in 1997 to the Nature Conservancy, and the book is about her life on the land.
I chose this book because it hits upon so many themes that are dear to my own heart. I've never met Heidi Red. She turned over some years ago. She ran single-handedly by herself after her divorce the over 5,000-acre dugout ranch adjacent to Canyonlands National Park. They also ran over 100,000 acres of Forest Service land and another 200,000 plus acres of BLM land. She was a female rancher in a very male world, and she did it successfully. And what I admire about Heidi Red is her journey, her commitment to the land, the landscape, the people, and the conservation of the land that is protected today. The truth is, I am never alone here. After 56 years, I have merged with this place. I am baked into the sandstone walls, and I am sifted into the coarse soil beneath the sagebrush. I'm guided by the wisdom of ancient souls, singing in the wind, signaling to me in the wisp of a cloud, and caressing me with the scent of the earth and the cry of the coyote. But I'm also keenly aware that I'm not alone in being claimed by these lands. Far from it. So many people look to this unique region for meaning or purpose or enrichment. I understand and value that many different indigenous communities knew these lands in ways that were physically, spiritually, and culturally important for thousands of years before I was here. I never met Heidi Red, but I feel like she's a kindred spirit. She speaks the truth. She speaks the truth about people and the land after 60 some odd years of living the life in a very, very remote place. She's my hero.
It's Ken Sanders reading from the book A Cowgirl's Conservation Journey by Heidi Redd and Larissa Bowen. Back to Ken now. This is the part of the show where we talk about children's books. Ken Sanders, get us started.
Okay, The Wishing Flower, brand new book, A.J. Irving and Kip Alizadeh. It's a beautiful new children's book, a grade school, young children who develop a friendship. And it's a beautiful book about how children make friends. There's a brand new book. This isn't technically a kid's book, okay? It's Wild Wasatch Front. So this is for the parents of the children because—
To take them out under the Wild Wasatch Front.
Yeah, except that you don't have to go very far. This is about the wilderness inside of the city. Huh. And it's just a wonder. It's really thick and detailed. Lots and lots of pictures of places that we know about and don't know about right here under our feet. And anyhow, it's just a beautiful book that'll take you to wilderness without using much gas. I'm going to go retro. David Wiesner, one of the greatest of all of the newer school of children's books author illustrators. I would put him up there with Chris Van Allsburg. He began his career as a child writing wordless pictures and poems. And he says that this old book of his is called Free Fall. It's inspired by a painting that Mr. Wiesner did that was 8 feet long and as almost as a child. And he reimagined it and re-illustrated it as a storybook. And it's just a beautiful story of a boy falling asleep and the adventures he has. And it's a beautiful narrative and story. And he doesn't use a single word. Free Fall by David Wiesner.
Great. Thank you.
Sorry.
Betsy Burton, over to you.
Well, I have one for what we should do with our kids in the summer, too, for parents, how to babysit your grown-up, activities to do together. So this is by Jean Reagan with Janae Brownwood, illustrated by Lee Wildish. It's sort of from the kids' perspective. It's the things that kids think they'd like to do with their parents. And it's a wild conglomeration, wildly and colorfully illustrated, of everything from spectacular ideas of things to fix in the kitchen, to making a volcano, to making a book, to finger puppets, you name it. They're all here, and it would take you all summer to do them, and I think you'd probably have fun with most of them. Then my favorite picture book this year is Luigi, the spider who wanted to be a kitten, Michelle Knutson and Kevin Hawks. Kevin Hawks is a wonderful illustrator. And this is a story of a big, fuzzy spider who drops into a house and is under the couch. And an elderly person, about my age probably, is sweeping and thinks she's found a nice, fuzzy kitten. And so she takes him into the kitchen and she plops him down and she said, "Would you like some breakfast?" And he's thinking, "This is pretty good." And then she gets a piece of string and she starts playing with it with him the way you would. They end up playing all day. They have a wonderful time. And they develop quite the relationship over time. And then some visitors come and the cat's out of the bag. It's not a kitten, it's a spider. And he flees in mortification and fear. She finds him, and she says, "Luigi, it's fine. I've known you were a spider for a long, long time, but you had such a good time pretending. I just couldn't bear to tell you. And I do love you just for who you are," our favorite message in kids' books. Then, for slightly older kids, kind of an early reader age, Kate DiCamillo, who's wonderful, has a book called Oris and Timble, The Beginning. That's important. Illustrated by Carmen Moak. It's about a little mouse who rescues the claw of this cute owl from a mousetrap. And before doing so, he tells the owl the story of the mouse and the mouse and the lion, because he's a little worried about what will happen when the owl has free will. And what happens is the owl wants another story and another. That's why this is the beginning. And then just briefly, a chapter book for kids 8 to 12, The Secret Language of Birds, Lynn Kelly. She goes away to a summer camp. She's kind of a shy young girl, and she loves birds. So she's in the wilderness by herself, which she shouldn't be, and she sees two whooping cranes. She thinks it can't be right, this can't be true, but it is. And this story of a summer camp and these whooping cranes is just a delightful read. The Secret Language of Birds, Lynn Kelly.
All right, Kat.
Okay, I'm going to start with some middle grade reader books. The first one is by Sarah Zarr, an author of middle grade realistic fiction and young adult realistic fiction. We're fortunate she calls Salt Lake home. Her latest book is called Kira Just for Today, and it is about a girl who's been too much for so long, too big, too loud, too everywhere, who's finally gotten her life just right. It's just enough. Her mom is in recovery. She has a good life. Things are going well. And then middle school happens. and things go off the rails. She's not enough anymore. And this is a book about telling the truth when the truth is really, really hard to tell, even if it's about somebody who loves and protects you like your mother. It's stunning, as all of her books are. It's called Kira, Just for Today. Next is a totally different book. This is a romp by Alicia Dow called Just a Pinch of Magic. This is about a family of magical bakers who are hit hard by inflation, man. It's rough on them there. And there's a dedicated child. She's desperate, and she doesn't know what to do to help her family. And the answer is illegal magic.
of course.
Yeah, that calls down the law. This is a wonderful, cozy, spooky book for those middle grade readers. And it's just the right balance of modern and kind of traditional fantasy. So, just a pinch of magic. And then David Robertson has a book called The Barren Grounds. This is book one of what will be a saga. This is about two Indigenous children in Manitoba. And they are sent to a foster home where they must live. And they're struggling to fit in for all of the reasons. Until they find a secret walled-off section in their room. And yes, this is The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, or it's got those vibes, but this is also important because it's Indigenous access and reclaiming of home, and that use of family that we need to find in the modern world. It's a wonderful transporting book. There will be more of it. It's called The Barren Grounds, and it's by David Robertson. Lastly, I have a book called Sam Francisco. That's the name Sam, S-A-M. King of the Disco by Sarah Tagholm. Sam, he's a DJ, and he wants to throw a party, but he's got this neighbor who's kind of sensitive to noise and grumpy. So the whole book is how to get around it. He and his friends need to work through a way. The colorful palette, the rhyme schemes, it's a vibrant book. It's like Pete the Cat, only so much better. So this is the one if you want to get out of Pete the Cat. Sam Francisco, King of the Disco by Sarah Tagholm.
Great. Look good. The children's book, terrific. Okay, I'm not sure if we have time, but let's do a lightning round. And I'll just go from my left to my right. Start with you, Betsy Burton. Just throw a couple out.
In this year when we really need comfort, there's a wonderful book called The Comfort of Crows, A Backyard Year by Margaret Wrinkle. It's not brand new, but it is comforting and wonderful. There is Dispersals, On Plants, Borders, and Belonging by Jessica Lee. And finally, Wisdom from the Hidden Life of Trees, which isn't little nuggets of wisdom, really. It's about trees, and it's lovely and small.
All right, I'm going to lean in on cocktail parties. Big Dip Energy, 88 parties in a bowl for snacking, dinner, dessert, and beyond. Spectacular spreads because everybody wants to make a charbougie board. And this will give you the way. Stucchini, the art of the Italian snack. Beautiful little Italian bites. All of these books are big and lovely food porn.
Perfect. Ken, over to you quick.
Wandering Stars by Tommy Orange, a novel of the Sand Creek Massacre of 1864 in Colorado.
That was lightning. Wow, incredible.
That's Ken what you called it?
I know it. Ken Sanders of Ken Sanders following, Rare Books.
Following Directions.
And on Second East in Salt Lake City and the Leonardo Museum downtown. Catherine Weller with Weller Bookworks in Trolley Square. Betsy Burton, of course, for many years, she was the co-owner of the King's English Bookshop on 15th and 15th in Salt Lake. Thank you all very much.
Thank you. Thank you, Doug.
We have a complete list of all of these books that we discussed and the ones, of course, we didn't get to because we didn't get to all of them. You can find it on our website, RadioWest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. We're also on YouTube at KUER90.1. Love to hear from you. You can email us at RadioWest@KUER.org. The program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Carrie Watson is our executive producer. I'm Doug Fabrizio.